Nimitz, South 880 after 7th Street Grand Avenue. Overturned box truck on its side. The two right lanes are blocked. Fuel spill to deal with, too. That's heavy into the maze. That Berkeley wreck, it's in the clearing stages. 80 westbound at Gilman. Everything on the shoulder. Bit of a delay back to Golden Gate Fields. And some trouble in Concord, northbound 242. The ramp to Highway 4 westbound. Dealing with a crash there on the shoulder of the ramp. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction. Thanks, Julie. Support for KQED comes from Save the Bay, imagining a Bay Area where people and wildlife thrive. This future is possible. Turn the tide and rise to the climate challenge. More at sfbaynow.org. I'm Dave Freeman. You're listening to KQED FM San Francisco and KQEI FM North Highland Sacramento, live online at kqed.org. 12 noon.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Deepa Fernandez.
And I'm Asma Khalid. It's Here and Now.
Coming up, Israel says it was targeting Hamas militants when it struck a UN-run school inside Gaza overnight, but dozens of Palestinian civilians were killed.
We have seen hospitals being bombed, we have seen refugee camps being bombed, we have seen humanitarian warehouses being bombed. The situation is apocalyptic.
Also, the opera Innocence gets its American premiere. It explores how a school shooting continues to affect the families of victims and the shooter a decade later.
In this opera, nobody is totally innocent or totally guilty. This opera is just talking about different kind of truths, different levels of truths.
But first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Israeli military has attacked a school complex in Nuseirat. The UN had turned the compound into a shelter for thousands of Palestinians displaced by nearly 8 months of war. Local officials say dozens of people, including children, were killed in today's attack. The Israeli military says it targeted Hamas operatives and was not aware of civilian casualties. A deadly strike was also carried out on a house overnight. A new report by UNICEF finds one in four children under the age of five is living in severe food poverty. NPR's Fatma Tanis says the assessment highlights what young children are being fed and what that means for their growth.
In parts of East Africa, babies are fed some breast milk and a bit of porridge. In Yemen, a paste with flour and water. And in conflict areas like Gaza, just raw lemon and weeds. UNICEF says 181 million children are only getting two or less food groups a day, which nutrition experts say amount to empty calories on their own. Those children are at increased risk of malnutrition, which stunts growth and can be life-threatening. But several low-income countries, including Nepal, Burkina Faso, and Rwanda, have made significant progress in cutting child food poverty rates by investing in local agriculture and regulating labels for unhealthy foods. Fatma Tanis, NPR News.
A federal judge has ordered former Trump White House advisor Steve Bannon to report to prison by July 1st. NPR's Carrie Johnson reports Bannon was convicted of defying subpoenas from the House committee that investigated the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol.
Judge Carl Nichols sentenced Steve Bannon to 4 months in prison on contempt of Congress charges. The judge allowed Bannon, a right-wing podcaster, to remain free pending appeal. But the federal appeals court in D.C. flatly rejected his arguments. And now the trial judge says Bannon needs to turn himself in, unless a higher court intervenes and orders more delay. Bannon also faces a state fraud trial in New York later this year. Another former Trump advisor, Peter Navarro, is serving prison time in Florida for refusing to cooperate with the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
The former Attorney General of New Jersey has taken the stand in Senator Bob Menendez's fraud and bribery trial in New York City. Prosecutors say the Democratic lawmaker unsuccessfully tried to pressure Gurbir Graywall to unlawfully intervene in cases involving associates of a friend. They say the former state AG took no action. Graywall is now head of enforcement at the Security and Exchange Commission. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 70 points. It's NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. California Supreme Court has ruled that UC Berkeley can start construction at People's Park. The university plans to build a student housing facility and a 125-unit supportive housing project on the site. The plan's opponents say they want to protect the park's history as a site for anti-war and environmental justice demonstrations in the 1960s and 70s, and neighborhood groups sued over the potential impacts of the new housing. Today, the state's highest court sided with the UC and cleared the way for construction to begin on the site, which has been barricaded with shipping containers since January. While the university plans to develop the student dormitory on its own, it still needs to find a developer for the supportive housing. And in other breaking news, a San Francisco judge has just dismissed some of the most serious state-level charges against the man who tried to kidnap Nancy Pelosi and assaulted her husband with a hammer. In the last hour, Judge Harry Dorfman granted a defense double jeopardy argument to dismiss attempted murder, assault with a deadly weapon, and elder abuse charges on the grounds that David DePapp has already been convicted for those acts in federal court. The surprise ruling will delay the state court trial currently underway for at least a week. The prosecution says they'll appeal today's ruling. DePapp still faces several felonies that carry a potential life sentence. Sports. All of our baseball teams got back to winning yesterday. The Giants beat the Diamondbacks. The A's beat the Mariners. The A's start back up at the Coliseum in half an hour. The Ballers won last night, too. They play again this evening with Kelsey Whitmore on the mound. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. And support for NPR comes from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And by the listeners of KQED.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Deepa Fernandez in Alameda, California.
And I'm Asma Khalid in Boston. It's Here Now. And we start this hour in Gaza, as we have done so often in recent months because of the latest news reports. The Israeli military appears to be launching an offensive in central Gaza, where many Palestinians have fled for safety. Earlier today, the Israeli military struck a UN school inside a refugee camp, killing dozens of Palestinians. Israel's military says it was targeting Hamas fighters. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, known as UNRWA, runs the school that was hit. And we are joined now by UNRWA's Director of Communications, Juliet Tuma, who's on the line from Amman in nearby Jordan. Juliet, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What more can you tell us about what happened at this school?
It's another attack on an UNRWA school. This is a school that was a shelter where 6,000 people who were displaced, who were forced to flee their homes, have been seeking refuge. This is not the first time. We have recorded that more than 180 United Nations, specifically UNRWA buildings, have been hit since the war began on the 7th of October in Gaza.
Juliet, what was the school being used for at this time? You mentioned 6,000 people were seeking shelter inside. Was it housing? Were there classes, education occurring inside? What is the purpose of the school at this point?
All schools have shut down when the war began, so children have been deprived of their education. All the UNRWA schools have been turned into shelters. These shelters, they are United Nations buildings, and they should be protected by law, including during wars. We have recorded that at least 180 of our buildings have been hit. Mm. And as a result, more than 400 people who were seeking shelter under the UN flag have been killed.
The Israeli military is alleging that there were Hamas fighters inside. Is there any evidence to support or to deny such a claim?
UNRWA is not able to verify these claims.
All right. I want to bring into the conversation now another voice. Karen Huster is with us. She's a medical advisor with Doctors Without Borders. She is inside of Gaza right now. Karen, welcome and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
So you have been back and forth, my understanding is today, to the Al-Aqsa Hospital, which is just a few miles from where this attack happened. What did you see? What have you been seeing?
The past 48 hours have been just really intense hours for Al-Aqsa Hospital. It's the only standing hospital pretty much that has been receiving all the patients from the Israeli strikes in the middle area. Arriving inside the courtyard, there were many bags of dead persons that had been brought inside. It was complete chaos. I just likened it to a ship that's sinking. People are trying to have their loved ones be seen by a doctor. It's just mayhem. Ambulances arrive, bringing either bodies or wounded. Everybody is rushed. There is no time for cleaning. Bodies are on the floor. Healthcare workers are completely, you know, exhausted. And we're just piling on mass casualty after mass casualty. Al-Aqsa Hospital is teetering on the brink of collapse, but still receiving patients.
You mentioned teetering on the brink of collapse. Can you describe what the situation is like today, how it's compared to what you all had been seeing in months prior? I mean, how many supplies do you have? How many do you need at this point?
Since May 7th, when the Rafah border was closed, there have been no medical supplies, no medical equipment, very little fuel crossing into Gaza. And so therefore, we have a hospital that is somehow, you know, surviving on whatever supplies are left, but we don't know for how long. Yesterday, for example, the generator stopped working for a little bit, and one patient, unfortunately, died because the ventilator was not getting electricity. And that is a problem that the hospital is really concerned about, because it is pretty obvious to everybody that having fuel is a requirement to run a healthcare facility.
What's the most acute need right now? Is it that fuel, that electricity?
I think the most acute need is a ceasefire, because it's the only thing that will allow for the scaling up of aid. It's the only thing that will allow for fuel to come in, for healthcare workers to come in. There are almost no hospitals standing in Gaza. Even international organizations have been asked to relocate their facilities. So there are more and more patients, and there are less and less capacity for the system to receive them.
That is Karen Huster, a medical advisor with Doctors Without Borders in Gaza, along with UNRWA spokesperson Julia Tuma. Thank you both very much for taking the time.
Absolutely. You're very welcome. Thank you for having us.
Karen, look after yourself. Keep up the great work.
Yes, thank you so much. And you too, keep the good work.
Thanks. Thank you.
Let's go back in time to 80 years ago today. An NBC broadcast from June 6, 1944.
Churchill told the House of Commons that upwards of 4,000 ships and thousands of smaller boats crossed the English Channel to begin the attack on the enemy's fortress Europe. One can only imagine the scenes on the English Channel as those thousands of ships, large and small, streamed across those waters towards the enemy shore.
D-Day, the day Allied troops landed on the beaches of Normandy, France, the biggest sea invasion in history, to break through the German lines and push the Nazis out of France. Veterans who took part in this pivotal battle gathered in Normandy today to commemorate the anniversary. They are all near or past 100 years old. Historian Garrett Graff collected the accounts of troops, commanders, planners, as well as reporters, politicians and civilians in a new book. It's called When the Sea Came Alive, an Oral History of D-Day, and it's out today. Garrett Graff joins us now. Welcome, Garrett.
Thanks so much for having me.
So the operation took an incredible amount of planning. Can you tell us a little bit about all the pieces that needed to come together to make it happen?
Yeah, this was, I think, in many ways, the most audacious event that humans have ever experienced before or since. You know, there were a million personnel for the Allies in motion across England and across the English Channel on June 6, 1944. 7,000 ships, the largest armada ever assembled, more than 3,000 planes carrying more than 10,000 paratroopers across the English Channel. And the success that the Allies had on D-Day begins in the weeks and months and years of planning and logistics and cooperation between the Americans and British militaries and governments, you know, dating back to the start of America's entrance in the war.
And there are so many dramatic stories of the landing. It was very difficult to land boats on the beach to make it across the sand. German troops were positioned up, shooting down as, you know, these soldiers came across the beach. Here's Norman Grossman, a veteran who spoke to WBUR in 2004, describing the landing.
What happened is the Higgins boat couldn't get all the way in. Most of us landed into water, which was probably waist deep. We had so much equipment. I had to shed a lot of equipment right away. I kept a little food, my shovel and my rifle. It's the only way I could move.
I mean, it must have been incredibly scary. Describe to us what it was like for these men.
Yeah. You know, they came ashore at Utah Beach and Omaha Beach often, as that veteran did, you know, their landing craft getting stuck further out to sea and then them really starting their D-Day invasion with a swim to the beaches. And, you know, when I talk about doing oral history, you know, what I'm normally talk about is that you're looking for the extraordinary and the ordinary. You're looking for sort of the most typical experiences and the most atypical experiences to include. And what really stands out on D-Day as you get into the archives of these stories is how ordinary the extraordinary was on D-Day, that how many of these men had, you know, experiences out at the outer limits of human survival, you know, amid some of the fiercest combat anywhere in World War II. But on that day, even necessarily in their units, they might not have had the most extraordinary story of that unit.
I wonder, Garrett, what you learned from talking in oral histories, which is a very unique form of collecting and learning from history, about the human spirit, because as you said, these were ordinary men charged with doing something extraordinary.
Yeah, what I love about oral history, what I think is unique about it as a form, is it puts you back in the moment, knowing only what the person knows at the time as they participate and live that event. You know, I think often with narrative history, there's a tendency as a historian to present things as neater and cleaner and simpler and more linear and predetermined than they were for the participants that day. And so, you know, in D-Day, you know, this day that we look back on as one of the greatest days in Western democracy, the most famous day of the 20th century, you know, when you read the letters of the soldiers crossing on the ships on the English Channel on the night of June 5th, or hear the memories of the paratroopers flying across the English Channel towards Normandy in the dark of that night, they're not feeling particularly courageous. They're not feeling particularly heroic. You know, they're lonely, they're scared, they're wondering whether they have what it takes to not let down their comrades and their friends as they face combat the next day, and they're wondering if they will live to see the next day. And, you know, I think understanding a titanic human event like this at that individual emotional level is just so important when you're marking an event like the 80th anniversary, where, you know, yes, it's the 80th anniversary, but really it's also the final passing of the generation that won World War II for us. And so, you know, my goal with this book, the 700 voices that I collected for it, was to try to tell the story of D-Day in the first person, in the voices of those participants, at a moment when this event is slipping from living memory permanently into history.
That's Garrett Graff. His new book is When the Sea Came Alive, An Oral History of D-Day. Garrett, thank you so much.
Thanks for marking this moment.
You're listening to Here and Now.
And also coming up on All Things Considered.
The D-Day invasion was 80 years ago today when Allied forces stormed the beaches of Nazi-occupied Normandy, France during World War II.
You are about to embark upon the Great Crusade toward which we have striven these many months.
The eyes of the world are upon you.
Over the years, NPR interviewed D-Day veterans. Hear their stories on All Things Considered from NPR News.
The interviews and more coming right up along with the latest news on KQED at 1 p.m.
An apartment complex in the small Gulf nation of Qatar, originally built for soccer players competing in the World Cup. These days, the place serves as temporary housing for hundreds of Palestinian refugees from the Gaza Strip.
And it will start from 5 a.m. for the breakfast.
We continue our series on survivors who've escaped the war in Gaza, next time on The World.
Coming up at 2 on KQED today, support for KQED comes from Berkeley Repertory Theater presenting Octavio Solis's Mother Road, an epic 21st century journey along Route 66 inspired by John Steinbeck, playing through July 21st, more at berkeleyrep.org. Visitorscoverage.com offering both inbound U.S. and outbound U.S. travel, medical, and trip insurance, so travelers are covered for financial risks and medical emergencies wherever they go. Learn more at visitorscoverage.com.
Funding for Here and Now comes from Boston University's Questrom School of Business, presenting the Is Business Broken podcast, conversations about the role of business, stakeholder relations, and government at bu.edu/Questrom or wherever podcasts are available.
It's Here and Now. School shootings are sadly all too common. Children die. Survivors suffer deep trauma. Families have to find ways to move on. But how much do we really know about the suffering and devastation that befalls a community impacted by a child shooting other children while at school? Well, a Finnish opera brings the deep pain of a school shooting to American audiences for the first time. This month, the San Francisco Opera premieres Innocence. Innocence is composed by the now late Kaya Sarriaho, with a libretto by Alexei Barriere and Sophie Oksanen. And joining us now is Klemon Maltakach, who is the conductor of Innocence. Welcome.
Hi.
We're also joined by Ryan Marchand. He's the head of diversity, equity, and community for the San Francisco Opera. Welcome, Ryan.
Thank you so much for having us.
So this opera opens 10 years after a school shooting. And we, the audience, don't know much at all. We just see people who look to be moving slowly, almost sleepwalking, kind of rehashing, reliving. Clement, why does this story start 10 years after the shooting?
I think the plot is to have a kind of trip between the past and the present. That was the first idea of the librettist, Alexei Barriere and Sophie Oksanen, and the composer Kaya Sarriaho, to have these traveling moments between what happened 10 years ago and what is happening now, and how we can face the events, how people are going ahead or keeping their trauma inside of them and are locked in their lives.
Let's talk a little bit about the Finnish composer Kaya Sarriaho. She died of brain cancer last year. She wrote this opera and it was first seen in France in 2021. Now it's come here to the US, playing for audiences in San Francisco. Why did she choose this? It's such an intense subject. I think opera and school shootings.
When Kaya got the idea to write a new opera, she invited both Alexei Barriere and Sophie Oksanen. And she wanted to write a multilingual opera. And in fact, everything came from a question that Sophie Oksanen asked to Kaya. What subject was not treated or done already in opera? And I think they decided that a mass murder and a shooting in a school could be not a good subject, but a great subject to face for opera nowadays.
And did it come out of a real life school shooting? I'm guessing maybe in Finland or somewhere in Europe?
That was related to many events, and it was always something very important for Kaya as well as for Alexei and Sophie, that this story is not coming from a specific event in America or in Europe. And it's why they put all the plot of the opera in Finland in an international school, because they wanted to have the audience facing the fact that it's something which is now in our lives and not only happening in a country.
Not just an American problem.
Absolutely. Even if there is a specific story of America with guns, with the Constitution, with the amendments, that's true. There are a lot of laws, but America is also a very large country. And it's also why there is sometimes maybe more events of that kind. But in a way, we are now in a world which is totally connected, and that kind of events are happening everywhere. It's a problem we are all facing in our lives.
I'd love to talk about the two mothers in the opera, the mother of the shooter and the mother of the child who was shot to death. Let's listen here.
Do you recognize me now, my dear friend? Patricia and I used to be friends. We baked cakes for the school's fairs. Look at us now.
So these mothers knew each other. Both their lives are shattered. And I found myself having empathy for both of them, even the mother of the shooter. Do you think that was Kaya's intention?
Yes, absolutely. I think to be able to feel compassion for characters which are very far from your own person is one of the greatest things you can experience in opera. And I think it's very important to understand that in this opera, nobody is totally innocent or totally guilty. This opera is just talking about different kind of truths, different levels of truths, and how they are coexisting.
And it feels like this opera is almost like a thriller. There's this really slow build, which it's like an onion being, each layer being peeled is something else being revealed about the event that happened 10 years earlier and the pain that's still so evident. And we don't want to give away too much because the slow reveal about each character, including the shooter, it's like a new gut punch as the opera goes on. But the one character I do want to talk about is the teacher. She goes on in the opera to talk about going back to read all the shooter's essays to see what she missed.
And I read all the essays the killer had written and looked for hints with a magnifying glass.
And then she talks about how she's going to be looking for clues in all her kids' writings. Little things like, is there a change in handwriting? And I realized I didn't think much about the impact on a teacher when one of their students kills others. What do you think, Clément, we can learn from her character?
I think she's an experienced person, and she tries to understand. For me, it's a metaphor of what we should do to face grief and suffering. At one point, you have to try to understand what happened, to understand that also everything before is not totally explaining what happened. And there is not only one answer, but many.
Ryan, let me bring you in. You know, I'll be honest, the opera left me, it was so powerful, I was so drawn in, but it left me kind of reeling, really feeling the pain of every character on stage. And I know that you and the San Francisco Opera have worked hard to help audiences. Tell me what will be on offer after seeing the performance.
Our guiding inspiration was hoping to be able to leave audiences with a sense of hope, despite how heavy the show is. So we try to think about what a person might need to sort of come back to earth and re-regulate themselves after watching that performance. So to that end, there will be a talk back after the show in the basement for anyone who's really interested in delving into the artistry and hearing from the artist how they created the work. There will also be spaces throughout the Opera House. There's a reflection space for people who might be feeling a little bit more quiet and introspective. There's a grounding space where we'll have some arts-based activities for people who are maybe a little bit more somatic and want to get back into their bodies. And we'll also have an advocacy space. We expect that people will feel really mobilized and want to do something to contribute to a solution. And all of these spaces are being curated alongside with us, with our community partners. We have a roster of about 4 or 5 different organizations that's working with us to curate these spaces.
It's fascinating because it's very unusual collaborating, and you know, the San Francisco Opera collaborating with local nonprofits, and some of this work is around ending gun violence. Mm-hmm. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, well, we felt we have this incredible piece of art. We're not the ones on the ground doing the work day to day to create safety in communities. That's where the partners come in. So we were really excited and inspired to use this piece of artwork to serve as a platform to bring light and focus to these issues, but acknowledging that we're not the ones working in the realm of those issues. And that's where we really rely on the partners to help bring that message to our patrons and our audiences.
You know, I have to say, my friend Annie and I, who saw the opera, we talked nonstop the entire way home about it. There was so much to it, and we just needed to process.
That's what we love to hear.
That's exactly what happens with this opera, and this is very important. It's why this opera was written, and it's why opera exists, to make people share their feelings and thoughts about what they saw and felt looking at the stage and listening to this music.
That's Innocence conductor Clemon Maltakach. We've also been speaking with Ryan Marchand, the head of diversity, equity and community for the San Francisco Opera. Thank you both so much for joining us.
We really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Innocence is running at the San Francisco Opera through June 21st. And you're listening to Here and Now.
Live from NPR News in Boston, I'm Steve Brown. Boeing's space capsule has successfully arrived at the International Space Station after encountering some thruster trouble. Docking was delayed to fix 4 thrusters on the Starliner capsule as the 2 NASA test pilots on board closed in on the space station. Starliner will spend at least 8 days at the station before aiming for a touchdown in the western United States. After the space shuttles retired, NASA hired Boeing and SpaceX to ferry astronauts to and from the space station. SpaceX's taxi service began in 2020. The widow of Beau Biden told jurors about the moment she found Hunter Biden's revolver in the console of his truck. In testimony today, Hallie Biden described putting the gun into a leather pouch, stuffing it into a shopping bag, and tossing it into a trash can outside a market near her home. Federal prosecutors have argued that Hunter Biden was in the throes of a heavy addiction when he bought the gun at the center of the case. He's been charged with 3 felonies and pleaded not guilty. Hunter Biden has said the Justice Department is bending to political pressure from Republicans. The number of Americans applying for jobless claims rose last week, but layoffs remain at healthy levels despite lingering inflation and high interest rates. Unemployment benefits applications for the week ending June 1st rose by 8,000. You're listening to Here and Now.
Afternoon support for KQED comes from SF MoMA, welcoming music lovers to celebrate 100 years of music and design. Art of Noise features over 800 works from rock posters to hi-fi listening experiences. On view now, more at sfmoma.org. Supermicro and NVIDIA accelerating AI with a wide range of AI servers and the NVIDIA AI Enterprise software platform. Supermicro is committed to driving AI infrastructure breakthroughs with rack-scale innovations. Afternoon weather, Bay Area. The heat advisory ends tonight at midnight. Look for sunshine the rest of today. Cooler, coast and bay. Low 90s inland. Clear skies inland tonight, then a slight chance of coastal drizzle and some clouds possibly after midnight. Sunny, cooler tomorrow, highs in the upper 50s to the low 90s. Hot today, Sacramento Valley, highs 94 to 84, cooler tomorrow with highs ranging from 89 to 99.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, and your NPR station. From MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. And BetterHelp, committed to helping clients with issues ranging from relationship challenges and goal setting to grief and depression. Learn more at betterhelp.com/public.
It's here and now, and we are just a mere few seconds away from Boeing's Starliner capsule docking at the International Space Station. The spacecraft is Boeing's first successful launch carrying NASA's astronauts, and if everything goes as planned, NASA might finally have more than one American-made vehicle available to take people into space. For more, let's bring in Brendan Byrne. He's Assistant News Director for Central Florida Public Media. Welcome to the show, Brendan.
Thanks, Ozma. And just as you started that sentence, the Starliner has docked at the International Space Station. It did dock, yes.
I love when that happens with live radio. So yes. So it was a safe, successful docking? Everything went as planned?
As of right now, yes. There's the initial contact is there, and now it'll go through a series of steps to do what they call a hard capture of the capsule, but everything is looking good at this moment.
That's great to hear. So who is on board this spacecraft?
Yeah, so there are two seasoned NASA astronauts are on board, Commander Butch Wilmore and pilot Sonny Williams. They're both no strangers to space. They've lived and worked on the International Space Station before. They're both Navy test pilots. So this is a program where they're thriving, right? They're taking a spacecraft out on its maiden voyage with humans in it. This is what they call a test pilot's dream mission to put this thing through its paces. And they're also carrying up some very important cargo with them as well. A urine pump for the International Space Station. The water reclamation system had a failure, and they are bringing some critical hardware up with them.
Does sound very viable, yeah. So, Brendan, I've got to ask, why is Boeing doing this? I mean, I feel like in my mind, it was NASA that shuttled its own astronauts traditionally back and forth.
It was, yeah. And in 2011, when the space shuttle program was retired, NASA realized it needed a way to transport those astronauts to and from the space station. So the agency called upon the commercial space industry to come up with a system to get astronauts up there. SpaceX came up with one, and Boeing received the contract for the other. But NASA wants to have redundancy built in. If something were to happen to one of these providers, and they only had one provider, then they'd have no way up to the station. So today is a very good day for NASA and its ever quest for redundancy in its systems.
Got it. It does seem like Boeing has had, though, a bit of a bumpy ride getting its spacecraft off the ground. In fact, I was just reading that there were a couple of helium leaks found yesterday, which I don't entirely know what that means, but if I was on that space capsule, it would make me a little nervous to hear about a helium leak. What do you make of that, and were there any threats actually to the crew's safety?
So they actually noticed the helium leak while it was on the ground before launch, and engineers did a thorough analysis and said there were no issues. They found some leaks in the system overnight after the astronauts had launched. There were some issues with what they call the RCS, the reaction control system. These are the thrusters that actually have the precise and minute maneuvers that help them get to the International Space Station safely. There were some issues with that. It could be related to the helium, but we're still not too sure about that right now. But right now, they're safely docked to the station and should be opening the hatch in an hour or so.
Great. I'm sure we'll keep an eye and an ear on that. Thanks so much. That's Brendan Byrne, Assistant News Director for Central Florida Public Media.
Thanks, Ozma.
You're in now. The
D-Day invasion was 80 years ago today when Allied forces stormed the beaches of Nazi-occupied Normandy, France during World War II.
You are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you.
Over the years, NPR interviewed D-Day veterans. Hear their stories on All Things Considered from NPR News.
The stories, the news, so much more. The early edition coming right up for you at the top of the hour at 1. Support for KQED comes from the San Mateo County Fair, featuring new this year, Great American Duck Racing, along with the Toytopia exhibit, carnival rides, food, and concerts June 1st through the 9th. For tickets, visit sanmateocountyfair.com. Comcast Business. When choosing Comcast Business Internet, customers are choosing a next-generation 10G network to help keep their business future ready. Comcast Business, powering possibilities. Restrictions apply. Here on KQED Public Radio, 88.5 San Francisco, also over the air, Sacramento, 89.3 FM Sacramento. Online at kqed.org this afternoon. Also available by smart speaker. Just ask your smart speaker to play KQED.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and your NPR station, and from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for chefs and designed for restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. And WBUR with ZSP Media, presenting Beyond All Repair, a new podcast investigating an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything and everyone. Listen now.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Vipa Fernandez in Alameda, California.
And I'm Asma Khalid in Boston. It's Here and Now. There is an ongoing debate about the climate crisis, and it's not about whether it's real. Some activists argue that the best way to inspire meaningful action to reduce emissions is to tell stories of hope. Others say we need to be brutally honest. In other words, we should use fear about the very negative effects of climate change on our planet to compel change. But what about humor? One online community is using funny, nature-centered memes to bring attention to ecology and climate change and to raise money for organizations that help animals. WBUR's podcast, Endless Thread, took a look at this community of nature nerds, which started as a way for a group of friends to keep in touch after college and now has hundreds of thousands of fans. Here are reporters Ben Brock Johnson and Dean Russell.
Wild green memes for ecological fiends. It is one of the nerdiest places I have visited on the internet. Co-founded by biologist Rhett Barker in 2017, the Facebook group has about 770,000 members, almost 200,000 more on Instagram and TikTok.
Many of the members are scientists. Many more are just, as they might say, ecological fiends. Co-founder Rhett Barker might sum up the vibe of Wild Green Memes as
relentlessly optimistic. Yeah, relentlessly positive works too.
As the name implies, this is a place for wildlife enthusiasts of a particular ilk. The kinds of folks who spend as much time outdoors as they do online.
And it's a place for memes about all kinds of animals and plants and fungi and bacteria. You've probably seen memes that went viral from here.
There is a meme about a cat-like animal from Madagascar, the Cryptoprocta ferox.
A scientific name that, as we learned, means ferocious hidden anus.
And then there's a pride meme about the way male gourami fish fight.
They kiss. It's adorable.
Rhett Barker says he never expected it to become so popular. Still, he gets it.
Because the reality of nature right now is anything but relentlessly optimistic.
We're living in an epoch many scientists describe as the sixth extinction.
Today's children will likely see thousands of animals disappear in their lifetime, from lizards to koalas and crabs.
So, Rhett says, people need memes. Nature needs memes.
Media and discussion about this topic has been largely negative, very doom and gloom. But I think that there's also room to just be excited about nature and to be positive.
Fear messages have typically not been really helpful.
Rupu Gupta is a conservation psychologist with the Hudson River Foundation, an environmental nonprofit in New York City. Like Rhett, she says the key to conservation is positivity and hope.
But then let's get to me, as you were asking, which brings in another layer of complexity in talking about humor, right?
Research in conservation psychology suggests that humor presents a new way of thinking about an issue, often a hopeful way that
takes you away to a different state of mind where you think, okay, like I'm feeling better at this moment compared to the moment before I had seen the meme, right?
If humor downplays the overall issue, it doesn't accomplish anything beyond those good feelings. It needs to be somewhat directed. You need to pair it with a thing to care about and a thing to do.
For instance, memes that center animals in its presentation can foster online actions like donating money to a campaign, that kind of thing.
In 2018, Ashton Biological Preserve fell on hard times. The private nonprofit in North Florida is home to endangered radiated tortoises and vulnerable gopher frogs. It operates on an annual budget of $30,000, all donations. That year, they were barely getting by.
When Wild Green Memes co-founder Rhett Barker heard,
it got me thinking, well, we have this group that's grown to around 10,000 people. Most of them are nature enthusiasts. Maybe we could do a fundraiser and help this nonprofit.
This is a group that excels at weird. They wanted to do something more creative than a Kickstarter. They settled on a charity battle.
I don't even want to say infighting, but there's like competition between like birders and marine biologists or like geologists and people who study living things.
This is Curtis Sarkin, another Wild Green mod and meme maker who also teaches science at summer camps and after school programs. Curtis says the idea was to pit people against each other based on their interests.
Like you could be in Trash Mob because you love gulls and raccoons, or Leafy Boys because you like leaves.
That'd be me. I'd be in Leafy Boys, I'm pretty sure.
And that's how you join the gang, by just saying saying I want to be in Leafy Boys. And now you're in it.
The idea was that you would donate to the biological preserve in the name of your chosen group. The group that raised the most got bragging rights.
The charity battle raised nearly $2,000, enough to keep the lights on at Ashton Biological Preserve. Herpetology Gang won.
In the years since that charity battle, it's become an annual event. In total, Wild Green Memes has raised almost $60,000 for Ashton Biological Preserve, money that was used to install solar panels, among other things. To the preserve, Wild Green Memes was practically a godsend.
The charity battle has been extended. The money now goes to a variety of projects, including rainforest restoration, funding pollination projects, and saving elfin butterflies. After 6 years, how much money do you think you've raised by now in total?
It's a little over $500,000 as of this year. Yeah.
Wow. All for memes?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Taking a, quote, relentlessly optimistic approach to nature may have its benefits, but when the reality of the situation is dire, could it also be misleading?
We are living through a climate crisis and mass extinction of our own making.
I don't think there's a way to be sunny and positive that's not perpetuating denial.
Margaret Klein Solomon is a clinical psychologist turned climate activist, and she's not as anti-meme as she sounds.
There is room for positive emotions and memes, but telling the truth is just critically important.
Knowledge and donations from non-billionaires can only go so far. Margaret says it is actions that matter, and
the core blockers to action are psychological and cultural.
Rupu Gupta, our other psychologist, told us fear prevents action. Margaret says that's
totally wrong. Fear is probably the most reliable motivator. It's the evolved mechanism through which we respond to threats.
Margaret told us that while she supported the philanthropic work of Wild Green Memes.
Yeah, I guess I would say I would love to see this group supporting the climate movement, like posting about places that people can join or get trained or support in addition to their lighthearted vibes.
One reason Margaret might value joining a movement over donations to pollinator projects and saving the elfin butterflies, both things that she thinks are great, is the 3.5% rule. Historically, if 3.5% of a country's population participates in mass protests, those protests have led to major change.
When it comes to saving nature, individual donations are great, but small. Lasting change comes from doing something together.
Ben Brock Johnson and Dean Russell from WBUR's podcast Endless Thread. You can find a link to the full episode at hereandnow.org.
Curious about the histories and mysteries of Bay Area cuisine? KQBD knows all things food, from recipes to guides on the busiest bites in the Bay. Visit explore.kqbd.org to explore all things Bay Area food. And support for KQED comes from the Asian Art Museum. Phoenix Kingdoms, the last splendor of China's Bronze Age, uses digital technologies to reimagine a culture buried by imperial history for centuries. Tickets at asianart.org. And by Sutter Health, with birth centers that never stop delivering joy and cancer clinical trials that never stop delivering hope. Sutter never stops caring for Californians at all stages of life. Learn more at sutterhealth.org.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, and your NPR station. From MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. And the Music Emporium, guitar sellers for more than 50 years. Celebrating the enduring presence of music made on the front porch and center stage. You can learn more at themusicemporium.com.
It's Here and Now. I don't know about you, but I feel like my kids are bombarded constantly with ads for the latest gadget or toy or shoes, and sometimes it's really hard to say no. So how do we raise our kids in an increasingly materialistic world? Alison Pugh is a professor of sociology at the University of Virginia and the author of Longing and Belonging, Parents, Children and Consumer Culture. When I spoke to her in December, I asked her how the ad culture targeting our kids has changed over time.
As you already know, as your audience already knows, it's increased dramatically. Starting with the advent of television and the spread of television from a collective experience that families viewed together to instead an individual experience where even middle childhood is walking around and even younger is walking around with their own screens. And that's provided advertisers with an increasingly specialized audience for their messages.
I imagine one of the implications of that is that we as parents, we don't even know what our kids are seeing when they're on their own screens and we're not collectively sitting there watching the TV with them. But I'm wondering if you're seeing the impact on spending. Is there a straight line between all these ads that are being pushed at kids and their desires, their parents spending on things for them?
I am so glad you asked that. First of all, the answer is definitely not. There is not a straight line between all the ads and what the kids want.
Hmm.
Advertisers are spending billions of dollars to try and find that straight line, but nobody really has the magic pill yet. And they keep trying. And to some degree, it's working. And that's why we're seeing so much advertising. They wouldn't do it if it was completely without some kind of result. But I would say that my own research, I spent 3 years watching kids talk about stuff, and they were 6 to about 10. And in that population, some of the stuff they're talking about is advertised, but so much is not. And really what kids care about is the meaning of particular goods and services and experiences in their social world.
And maybe is that partly because I think it's changed so much. It's not just a straight ad on TV. I think we have things like toy unboxing videos, which, you know, could just be seen as like how you open a new toy, but really it's pushing a toy. And then you have influencers, even for children as young as the age group you're talking about, where they walk around showing off things. And I think to me, it seems like I want to be like them. I want what they have.
You're right to point to it. I mean, it is a billion-dollar industry. But I often find that that's the part that parents know already. But the surprise is how much it has to do with the kids' desire to belong to a social world. And that taps into what parents themselves are doing and responding to. Parents themselves are very susceptible to please by children on the basis of, you know, if I don't have this, I won't be able to be a part of my friendship group. It's super hard. Who wants to consign their child to loneliness? Another thing I would say is we're so used to hearing about how kids today are materialistic and they just want things, and that's the engine for spending in today's families. I actually want to push back on that a little bit. What I saw was not kids wanting to be better than Jane down the street. They want to be able to talk to Jane down the street and to be able to use whatever common goods that they have, you know, the latest toy or whatever, to be able to talk to each other.
And that's a compelling reason for a parent. You want your child to be a full social citizen, as you say. So give us some advice. How do we go forth when our kids are just getting these buy, buy, buy messages?
Don't worry about not buying. Because the kids are going to be fine. That's what I saw. Kids being incredibly creative and flexible when they faced the kind of inevitable possibility that they didn't have what everyone else was talking about. So even if you are incredibly wealthy and spend all your disposable income on your child and you say yes to everything, every child, no matter their background, is going to have an experience of at least once not having what everyone else is talking about. And when I watched kids manage those moments, they were really creative and great. They would look around and figure out the vocabulary that everyone was using to be able to be fluent in this or that toy. They would borrow it from friends so that they would figure out how it works and then be able to talk about it. They would pretend that they were going to get it or they had it last week. They would have alternative ideas that were close but not the same. You know, like they just were kind of creative and doing their best.
Alison Pugh is a professor of sociology at the University of Virginia and the author of Longing and Belonging, Parents, Children, and Consumer Culture. Alison, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Here and Now is produced by a stellar crew of people at NPR and WBUR. I'm Deepa Fernandez in Alameda, California.
And I'm Asma Khalid in Boston. The latest news is next. You've been listening to Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from Boston University's Questrom School of Business, presenting the Is Business Broken podcast. Conversations about the role of business, stakeholder relations, and government at bu.edu/questrom or wherever podcasts are available.
Here's what you can plan on tomorrow morning on Morning Edition.
Healthcare in the U.S. is expensive and can be hard to navigate.
If you have had job-based coverage your whole life and suddenly you lose your job, you might not know where to go.
For our series, We the Voters, we discuss the health policies of President Biden and former President Trump. That's tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Catch it tomorrow morning, 2 o'clock until 9 a.m. Also, KQBD News and the California Report. It's the early edition of All Things Considered in just a minute. Now, Julie Depesch with Bay.